welcome to today's colloquium. Today's speaker is Nandini Trivedi. She's here teaching the Psy course, so again, I should be very familiar to all the Psy students. She's teaching the Psy course in condensed matter. She did her bachelor's in Delhi and then did a PhD at Cornell University, finishing in 1987. And then she spent a number of years back in India at the Tata Institute before returning to this part of the world where she got a professorship in the Department of Physics at the Ohio State University. Today she's going to talk to us about high temperature superconductivity and the optical lattice emulator.
Thanks, Lucy. So good afternoon, and I get to see all of you again, many of you again. thank you again for the invitation to give a colloquium here. I've had a lot of fun interacting with all of you, and you'll see some of the concepts we've been talking about come together now in my research. My talk will be on connecting different areas in condensed matter. We move on this side. So, do we have the lights down here?
They listen to us.
Okay, so broadly, the effort right now is driven in condensed matter physics is driven in the following way. There are wonderful materials, very complex materials that throw up from time to time amazing phenomena. For example, high temperature superconductivity, different kinds of spin liquids in magnetic systems, and so on. So that's all happening here through novel materials that may not even be naturally occurring, but could be artificially made in the lab. Now, these are messy systems. So, you know, as physicists, we like to understand them at some level. So we typically extract models out of these messy systems. And these models are, of course, very simple at face value. They look simple. And I will introduce some of these to you today. They could be what are called Hubbard models, particles with interactions, Heisenberg models, spins, which are spins with interactions. But at the same time, there are questions on two fronts. One is, are these models a good representation of the real systems? And secondly, there are also problems because even though they may be simple, we can't always solve them. So a very drastic idea that has come up recently is to use a quantum computer. And by quantum computer, what I mean, it's an emulator. So what is done is, these materials here have complicated elements, copper, strontium, very complicated elements. But you can substitute that by a completely different system in which you make a lattice using lasers, load them with atoms like lithium and sodium, very simple alkali atoms, but nevertheless engineer in these lattices the same models that you were that had been extracted from these materials. So you engineer these models in a completely different setting. And why do we do that? The hope is that you can now experimentally try to emulate that Hamiltonian and see what kinds of ground states you can get. So that's kind of the grand design of where the field is headed, or I should say one part of the field is headed. So broadly, the aim is, given some Hamiltonian which has been extracted, can we get phase diagrams in this parameter space? Okay, so the outline of my talk will be the following. I will start with high temperature superconductivity. It is the major problem in our field today that while we have made some progress on this problem, it still remains unsolved. So I will then discuss the Fermi-Hubbard model, and then from there take you to the optical lattice. But these are still early days for this optical lattice, so at this point there hasn't been too much progress on the experiments. So then I will shift gears and go to the Bose-Hubbard model, which is closely related, where one can say a lot more about the system. And in particular, what is nice about the Bose-Hubbard model is that there is a quantum phase transition that takes you from one phase, a superfluid phase, to an insulating phase. And I will discuss how we can probe it by a variety of methods. On the technical front, what you will see, my expertise is in Monte Carlo methods, and you will see different Monte Carlo methods. It's not like one black box that you crank up, but there are different methods you will see in action, a variational approach, which is variational by the name as it goes. And there you will see Monte Carlo more as an approximate way of evaluating integrals. But then you'll see two other methods for fermions and bosons, which are practically, I should say, numerically exact. Okay, so high temperature superconductivity. And this may be the shortest, most precise rendition of this subject you might have seen, because I'll do it in about 5 or 10 minutes. So here is how it started. A very complex looking material, you can see it has four elements: lanthanum, strontium, copper, oxygen. So some complicated set of materials hit the news in 1986, 1987, because it showed this phenomenon. Here's the resistance as a function of temperature. This is high temperatures. The system is resistive like a normal metal. And you reach a temperature of about 100 Kelvin, and boom, there's a big phase transition. The system enters a new ground state, extremely ordered ground state with zero resistance. So this is what took everybody by surprise, because the temperature was about 100 Kelvin. It's not like they didn't know about superconductors. They knew it all along since 1900, but the temperatures at which this phenomena was typically seen was about 10 Kelvin, and now it shot through the roof to about 100 Kelvin. Now, that's on the experimental front. As theorists, what was very attractive and very exciting about this material was not the temperature, because that's just some coupling, some scale, but the phase diagram. So what you see is, this is temperature here. This axis here is controlling the concentration of electrons. So the key player in this material is a copper-oxygen plane, and essentially you have these sites, and at each site you have one carrier, one electron. And that state where every site has one electron is denoted by zero. There are no holes. So essentially X is the number of holes. And what you see is the parent material is an antiferromagnet. You start adding holes, it becomes a superconductor, and then becomes a normal Fermi liquid. And at finite temperatures, there are various interesting phases. I don't want to go through that in detail, but all I want to say is, why was it that theorists were excited about this problem? And the central reason is that three major paradigms of condensed matter physics were broken just by this one material. So the first one is that at X equal to zero, the parent material turned out to be an insulator, and it should have, by standard considerations, been a metal. So that was the first indication that there was something strange happening. The second one was, at finite temperatures, it did not act like a usual metal. And by that we mean typical metal has quasi-particles, and they have lifetimes which behave in a certain way with temperature, and this did not look like that. So it was a strange metal. So Fermi liquid theory did not work. And the third point was that the superconductor, which we've been studying in class, the BCS superconductivity theory, also failed in this region. And the way you can see that is, usually in a superconductor, there's one temperature scale TC at which the system loses superconductivity, and the gap, which is the order parameter in a superconductor, also closes. And that happens here, but at low doping, or which is also high concentration of electrons, you don't see that. You see two temperature scales. One, the lower one, where you lose sort of the superfluid properties of the superconductor. The zero resistance property is lost here, But the gap continues to exist up to a much higher energy scale. So you see this strange pseudo-gap phase, which was also never predicted by BCS theory. So right in one shot, three paradigms have broken. So obviously, it's a very important field to get into and explain all this. And there is some messy physics going on here, which I won't enter. There are also issues about whether there are critical points under this dome. OK, so that's the problem we have at hand. And you know, you look at this, you look at the material, and you say, wow, can we ever hope to understand something as complex as this material or this phenomenon? And you know, if you look at it, this is where the insight of some people comes through so beautifully. This is Phil Anderson, Hubbard, and Gutzwiller. They have been thinking about correlations between electrons, the repulsive correlations for many years. And Hubbard, Anderson in particular, for the high TC problem, proposed the so-called Hubbard model as the fundamental model to describe this phenomena. So what I find really amazing is that from this complexity, rather amazingly, a lot of the physics can be understood from very simple local interactions. And so that's when the Hubbard model enters the scene. This is what it looks like. It's a lattice model in which you have electrons that hop from one site to another. And that's described by a term like this. It's a non-interacting electron model here. But then on top of that, there is a strong repulsion if two electrons sit at the same site. And this just happens because of the nature of the quantum chemistry involved. So the repulsion is a very strong perturbation. It's really not the perturbation. It is the dominant term in the Hamiltonian. So typically, we know how to handle problems where U is small. But now we are in a regime where U is the dominant term. So that's the model they proposed, or rather, Anderson proposed for this messy copper oxide problem. And you look at that and you say, well, you know, it's all very well and nice, but does this model, simple as it is, have anything to do with reality? And what I mean by reality is that stuff that we saw. And the answer to that is best seen from art. So you see here, these are sketches by Picasso. He took this bull, and he's thinking very much like a physicist. He's trying to go through these successive renditions, and finally he comes up with the model, the Hubbard model right there. And you can say, well, does this model have anything to do with reality? And I'm sure you will answer, yes, it does, because it is not a spherical cow. It has all the necessary structure it needs to have. And so, you know, the Hubbard model should be viewed in the same context. But what I'll tell you next is that there is rather surprisingly much action in this simple-looking model, and you can extract it in the following way. So what this large U is telling us is that the Hilbert space has certain pieces which must be removed. There are configurations where you have two particles at a site, and those configurations are unfavorable. That's the key physics that is driving the strong correlations in this material. And as a consequence, this model, which had a lot of charge fluctuations because of these electrons hopping from one site to another, these charge fluctuations are getting suppressed because of this large U. And what emerges is spin physics. So once you suppress charge fluctuations, you are getting configurations which are singly occupied. But not only they are singly occupied, there are also some spin structure in that. And that forces these spins to be more antiferromagnetically aligned than in the same direction than ferromagnetic. Because if they are oppositely aligned, you can have this exchange process where you go from up, down to down, up. And that can give you a lowering of the energy by an amount given by this exchange constant, 4T squared over U. So right away, from suppressing charge fluctuations, some spin, antiferromagnetic spin physics has emerged in the low energy scale. Okay. So I can skip through some of this. This says the same thing. The reason the paradigm, the first paradigm broke is because within band theory, at half filling, which is when you have one electron per site, the system would have been a half-filled band, and that would have been a metal, but it is precisely these strong correlation effects that has driven it into what is called a Mott insulator. And that Mott insulator has a charge gap, but it has low-lying spin physics, antiferromagnetic spin waves, which are existing in the low-energy sector. Okay, now that's already very interesting that we have managed to get a spin Hamiltonian out of original Hamiltonian that had these charges in motion from the repulsive interaction. But now what I'll show you is that this repulsive Hamiltonian also has pairing. So in the class, what we have seen when we were going through this psi class is that BCS superconductivity came about because of effective attraction between the electrons. Here we have a repulsive Hamiltonian, but yet it has indicators of pairing physics in it. And the way you see that is, once again, this is the Hubbard Hamiltonian. At low energies, you get this Heisenberg Hamiltonian, which is spin interactions between the adjacent spins. And from here, you can write a bond operator, which is a pair operator where you create a down and up electron and with this negative sign. So it is a singlet bond operator. And this Heisenberg Hamiltonian can be exactly transformed into this form through these singlet bond operators. And Bhaskaran, who's in the audience, played an important role in this in the early stages. So what you are seeing here is from antiferromagnetism, you get a negative sign, which is effective attraction in these singlet bond operators. And this is generating attraction in the D wave channel. So this is all rather profound, that a repulsive model has living in it, has indicators of attraction, effective attraction in these bonds. And to visualize this, you can look at two sites, and it gives you this entangled state, up, down, minus, down, up, the spin singlet state. If you have four sites, you get these other resonating spin liquid states, where you form singlets of the horizontal ones and the vertical ones, and so on. And you can represent these states through these wave functions, the so-called resonating valence bond wave functions. So slowly what is happening is we can build up a variational wave function for this Hamiltonian. And if you have many such electrons, you can start pairing them up and making a Slater determinant. And the Slater determinant is essentially a soup of these singlets. This projection operator has the role of removing any configurations in the Hilbert space that have two electrons on the same site. So that's the physics that is coming out. And now we are in this happy situation. We have a Hamiltonian. We have a possible wave function. And we can start to see if it describes some of the physics. So what I mean by calculations on this state, what it requires is evaluating matrix elements for any operator you may want by doing this large multi-dimensional integral. And this is where one can use Monte Carlo methods. So I won't take you through that, but let me just indicate one result that comes out of it, which gives us much hope that we are on the right track. And that is, so what is shown here are two quantities. One is the gap in the spectrum. So if you take the superconductor and look at the energy gap, this is what it looks like as a function of x. At the same time, if you look at the order parameter, by looking at this correlator is telling you about a pair correlator. And at large distances, it goes to a constant, and that is the order parameter shown here.
Sorry, what is x?
X is the doping. X is, so I have,
in the Hubbard model, I mean. Yeah. So I have these sites. I have NS sites, and I have NE electrons. And at x equal to 0 implies that NE is equal to NS. And as I move away from that, x is 1 minus NE over NS. Okay. Sorry. So when this is equal, yeah, that's right. So x equal to 0 is often called half filling because it has one electron per site. Full filling would have been two electrons at a site. And then as I move away, then I'm putting in some holes. So we should think of x as holes. And what x does is it makes the system more and more dilute. So when I come here, I have very few electrons in the system. Now the repulsion that was the driving force behind this phenomena is not so important. So in this regime, you clearly see that the gap and the order parameter are equal. And that is one of the predictions from BCS theory, that the gap in the spectrum should be the order parameter, which is true here. But when you come toward x equal to 0, that's where you have a lot of electrons. The strong correlation becomes important. And now you see the two scales are beginning to diverge. And the reason for that is very simple, because of the strong correlation, when you look at the order parameter, which is a measure of taking two electrons from one place and trying to put them coherently into another position far away, that is becoming very difficult to do because it is such a packed system. And these electrons are interacting very strongly, repulsively. And that's what pushes phi to 0 here. On the other hand, the pairing gap is a measure of these singlet bonds that I was showing you, the energy to break one of those bonds. And that is still finite in this regime. And that is a simple way to understand the so-called pseudo-gap phenomena, where you can lose coherence but still have a gap existing in the system. Okay, so the main point of this is not to go so much into high TC, but to say that there is a simple model, you can do some kind of variational calculation on it, and you can start to see some basic aspects of the phenomenon emerging. Now, of course, you might say, and you know, this is just one quantity I showed you, there are a host of other things you can calculate, and they all are agreeing in very good agreement with the basic phenomenology that is observed. So you know, you can ask the question, is the high TC problem then solved? And at this point, the main issues are that the approach I described was a variational approach. It cannot allow us to handle finite temperatures. You know, there are many other aspects of transport in the strange metal regime. There are issues about electron fractionalization. Does the electron quasi-particle exist, or does it fractionate because of strong interactions? And all these issues are still not fully understood. And why is that? Why are we not able to make progress here? The effective theories that you get are very strongly coupled gauge theories. So people are trying to solve those by including string theory methods, ADS-CFT, and other methods are being used to address the behavior of these strongly coupled systems. So now I'm going to ask this question, which is, you know, what is the essential physics that we want to understand, and what is all the messy stuff? Now, we can't separate that in the experiments because that's the material. So the fact that the Hubbard model has been so successful, the question we want to ask is, could we just understand that model rather than the actual phenomena in the material, which could have many other factors going on? And that is one of the reasons the field has not been able to come to some consensus, because in the real system, there are many other charge ordering and other phenomena that murky up the situation. So that's where these optical lattice emulators come in. And the main point there is, again, back to that little bull, is to use these emulators to just focus on the model that was extricated. Okay, so any questions at this point? Okay, no? Okay.
I just wanted to
say, yeah.
You can catch the
food by your heart. And I will. And this is, the optical lattice will do that. Okay, so here's how it will catch it. We'll do it with lasers. So here, what is done is to artificially create the situation we had in the condensed matter system. So two lasers are used to create the standing wave, or rather you can put two mirrors to create the standing wave, and you can control the lattice. And atoms will be loaded into this, and they will sit in the potential wells here, and the lattice constant can be controlled with the laser wavelength, as well as the depth of the potential through the laser intensity. Okay, and people can now make all kinds of lattices in different dimensions, 1, 2, and 3. So the focus is no longer just trying to solve high TC or the Hubbard problem. You can make, you can, you know, this subject can take on a life of its own, which it has. And what is important is that we can get a very close link between the experiment and theory. So the in other words, the parameters of the Hamiltonian, the Hubbard Hamiltonian had two parameters, the hopping from one site to another, and the U, which was the on-site repulsion. Those can be determined directly from this experimental laser potential. So I'll just go through this quickly just to give you an idea how it is done, and you don't need to know the details. But the point here is, this is some sinusoidal potential for which you know the exact eigenstates. These are the block states, which are traveling waves, or you can have these localized states, which are orthonormal. And in these, And in this potential, when you have two atoms, they interact with some scattering length A, and there's a density-density interaction that dictates what the value of that effective U will be in the Hamiltonian. So by doing such a manipulation, you can get the value of U as the laser intensity is tuned. Similarly, hopping is nothing but looking at the overlap of these one-year wave functions on two different sites. And once again, you look at the del square operator in these states, and that gives us T, the hopping. So from this, you can, given a laser intensity, you can exactly find what is T over U as a function of the increasing intensity of the laser. And that is the single parameter in the Hamiltonian that will dictate what kind of phases you have. So in the Hubbard model, or rather I should say in this copper oxygen material, T over U was a fixed value of a tenth. U was 10 times the hopping. But here you can tune it to anything you want, and you can look at the entire phase diagram. So already you've gained a lot in these optical lattices by having the kinds of tuning of interaction which are rarely available in any material. A material will typically have a fixed interaction that it is born with, given the quantum chemistry, but here you can start adjusting this. Okay, so the result of this is through these optical lattices, using various kinds of atoms, you can get Hubbard models where T and U can be tuned, but you can also tune other parameters like the population difference between up and down, the total number of them, and so on. And this can be done, as I said, for fermion atoms as well as boson atoms. So that's the new system that we have to play with. Yes?
In the control of these parameters, so for example, what is the range of duration between T over U that one can achieve experimentally?
So, you know, one of the factors is, I've sort of talked about just a one-band Hamiltonian. If I look at a well, I will have many levels here. And each of them will broaden up into bands when they start talking to each other. So one of the things you want to do is to keep these in a regime where you're not exciting things into the higher band. Okay? But otherwise, in the single band model, it is literally a continuous knob that takes you from T over U. So let me see. It will take you from T over U, which is much, much less than 1, to T over U of about 20, 30, 40, and so on. So it can cover an entire range over which you can see the interesting physics, from weak coupling to strong coupling. It's very precise. OK, so the next thing you might ask is, OK, so now we have these optical lattice emulators. And I said you can make a repulsive Hubbard model in that. So what is the answer? Does the repulsive Hubbard model have superconductivity or not? And this is where things are a bit slow right now. So I want to give you a quick view of where we are in this problem, or where the experimentalists are on this issue. So what they are trying to do right now is first look at three dimensions. So as I said, the high-TC problem was mainly happening in these two-dimensional layers. That's not what people are doing right now. First, they want to just make a lattice in three dimensions and demonstrate that at half filling, it has this antiferromagnetic order. That's the first goal. And even that has proven to be rather difficult at this stage. So let me bring that up in the following way. Here's a phase diagram at half filling. This is temperature, and this is the repulsion. And there are these different energy scales you can draw here. So there's the first temperature scale here is on the scale of U. So as you're coming down in temperature, when you hit a scale of order U, at that point, you start to see this double occupancy getting suppressed and local moments forming. That's these blue and red atoms. These are the two spins of the electrons, or the fermions in this case, and they start to have the single occupancy. So at this stage, people have seen this double occupancy suppression in the experiments. Now, further coming down in temperature, there's a second scale that you hit, which is the exchange scale of order T square over U, called the nail ordering temperature scale, where these local moments that had formed at high temperatures start to order antiferromagnetically. So far, people have not entered this regime. They are still up here in the high temperature regime. And this problem already itself is also interesting. It allows you to go see the evolution from band antiferromagnetism to Heisenberg local moment antiferromagnetism. But the key problem in these cold atom experiments is that they don't have temperature as the knob they can vary. We are very used to in experiments in condensed matter, and when I say we, I'm a theorist, but okay, one expects our experimental friends, they tune the temperature, and then they observe all the results from that temperature change. In the cold atom experiments, they work at constant entropy. So it's a very different situation, because these are closed systems. All the changes are adiabatic. So the entropy is constant. And then they change the laser intensity, or whatever changes they make. These have to happen at constant entropy. So the question to ask is, what entropy do you need to see these ordered phases, not what temperature?
And for small u, are they able to see Fermi surface?
Yes, yes. I didn't show that, but they can. It's a very nice, they can see, because it's a square lattice. The Fermi surfaces have these square shapes.
They can see that.
And because they image, I'll come to that later, in real space, when the system comes out of their of their apparatus, it looks like a cube. Because real space is an image of the momentum space. So yeah, that has been done. And this is by Esslinger in ETH. So if you look at the entropy, the maximum entropy is log 4, because I have 4 states per site, 0, up spin, down spin, and double occupancy. That's the maximum entropy of 1.4. Currently, the experiments are at 1 kb. And you know, we call these ultra cold atoms. They are really operating at micro and nano Kelvin temperatures, but in terms of the entropy, they are very, very hot right now. And they need to go to an entropy of about 0.3 or so to see this antiferromagnetic phase. So there's a lot of work for our experimental friends there. Okay, now this is not something I want to go into, but some of the simulations we have done show that even with having much higher entropy, because these systems are in a trap, you can redistribute entropy and get to this nail state with a much higher total entropy per site. So this is quite significant because it tells us you don't need to cool that much as you would have had to for a uniform system. But because these are in a trap and the entropy can be shared in different places, you can get there with a higher entropy. Okay. What these calculations have required is getting the equation of state for fermions which are interacting with some potential U, this potential strength U, and at some chemical potential. So these are very difficult calculations because you're not at half filling, but you're away from half filling. And we've made some breakthrough here for being able to get this equation of state and from that getting the entropy. Okay, but I'm going to shift gears again. This is the story with the Hubbard model and why we want to go to optical lattices and the progress that has been made so far. So you can see that the issue about high temperature superconductivity away from half filling will be a long time in the future, because at this stage, even the antiferromagnet has not been seen. But I wanted to bring this up because it's a story that is worth looking out for. It will be making headlines when they get there. Yeah.
Can't you easily tune the gap so that even a moderate temperature is very low in entropy?
Yeah. So you the gap.
What is easier, to tune the gap, to make a bigger gap, or to lower the temperature?
Not yes. The... So what happens is if you the gap. This is what the gap looks like, and it scales with U. So clearly, if you go to a very large value of U, the gap is huge, and you can come down below the gap. But at the same time, this nail temperature also decreases with large U as T square over U. So there's an optimal value where you want to be, where the T nail is the highest. And that's around U of order 10. And at that point is where people are trying to cool. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is go to another model, the same model actually, the Hubbard model, but for bosons, where there has been a lot more progress. So this is now taking the Bose-Einstein condensate, which was obtained some years ago, in a harmonic trap. It was possible to cool the bosons low enough, so they all got into one quantum state, and that's the BEC. And now you turn on an optical lattice. So you put this BEC in a lattice and see what happens to it. And what that brings to the problem is another knob. And that knob, once again, the Hamiltonian is given by this. There's a hopping term and an interaction term between two bosons at the same site. The same kind of Hubbard model, except I don't have spin. You can also add spin for bosons. But at this stage, I don't have spins. So what you are seeing is, I'm going to look at this problem at zero temperature, so I don't bring in other incoherent effects. And what you're going to see is, essentially, the number phase uncertainty principle play out. So at large tunneling, when T is dominating over U, what you have is large number fluctuations, and you have a coherent state, a superposition of these different number states, and that results in a state with a fixed phase, and that's the superfluid phase. On the other hand, when you go to large U, number, the system gets into a fixed number state, and as a result, the conjugate variable, which is the phase, starts fluctuating. And this competition then drives a transition from a superfluid to a Mott insulator. And it's a quantum phase transition because it occurs at zero temperature by tuning this ratio T over U. So now we have a system of these optical lattice systems, and the question is, how could we probe these phases, and even more than the phases, how can we get into the quantum critical regime? So the way the experiments are done, you take these systems in the trap with the optical lattice, and then you turn off all the potentials and take an image of the emerging atoms. So you image them in real space, and you image the density profile. So what is observed are these dark spots, and that is an image of the number of atoms that you pick up at that location. So it's a real space image, but it will it essentially will give you a Fourier transform of the distribution. So you can think of these images as taking matter waves from each of these wells. You have matter waves in these wells, and when they expand, these waves interfere. And depending on whether the matter waves are coherent or incoherent, you get different kinds of pictures. So what I want to point out is that the real space is directly linked to the momentum space, and as a result, these are pictures of the momentum distribution of the bosons. Okay, any questions? Okay, and this is what is found. This is real experimental data. Of course, it has been colored, a false color plot on that. But here is the superfluid, where the atoms are in a coherent state and fluctuating between different configurations. That results, so the BEC that you saw before, which was this one single spike, now has spikes at all the other reciprocal lattice vectors as well. So that's the coherent superfluid. On the other hand, the Mott insulator, which has a very, in real space, it has atoms at fixed positions, so it looks like a crystal, but in terms of the phases, it is a very incoherent state. All the phases are fluctuating, and that results in this blobby structure in the interference pattern. And this is all happening not because of temperature, but because of quantum fluctuations of the phase. Okay, so these data were taken by Emmanuel Bloch's group, and they were able to tune that T over U. This axis is T over U, and they were able to tune that and see this sequence of pictures. And they attributed these very sharp pictures to a superfluid, and these blobby ones to a Mott phase. And what I'm going to show you next are some simulations which says that actually there could be a lot more physics in these pictures coming also from quantum criticality. And that's what these simulations help to unearth. Okay, so the simulations I will discuss now are path integral simulations of this kind, where we discretize space and time, and these bosons have some dynamics, and they follow different, these are the different boson whirl lines, and we have to sum over all these different permutations and configurations, and that is done using Monte Carlo. And the reason we do that is because while you can do analytical calculations in both the phases and near them, once you come toward the quantum phase transition, those analytical approaches break down. And so the quantity we want to focus on goes to the heart of how we would define a superfluid through the local order parameter. And by looking at the correlation function at large distances, this is the condensate density. And we calculate that in the simulation by looking at this correlator and seeing its large distance decay, or by Fourier transforming and looking at the height of that delta function. And what you see is that this is at zero temperature as a function of interactions. So on the right-hand side is large tunneling, that is weak interactions. This is small tunneling or strong interactions. And you see that delta function peak starting to decrease, and finally at the transition, it goes to zero and remains zero below that. So this is the indicator that the ground, you know, it's not like because the tunneling is getting smaller, you just got some sort of blah signature. The, you know, the condensate just kept getting smaller and smaller and then went to zero. But it did something very sharp at a particular value of the coupling. The condensate vanished. So that was the quantum phase transition, where something violent happens, the ground state restructures, and you get something quite different below that. And at the bottom line, the reason this is happening is because of vortices. So the condensate is the density of your bosons, which are in the superfluid state. And they're at zero temperature, the reason it is being degraded is because of vortices that are getting nucleated in the system, and that is causing the phases to fluctuate, ultimately giving you a completely phase disordered behavior below that. Okay, let me skip that and come here. So now we can also look at the behavior in temperature. And for that, what we do is you can look at the condensate density as a function of temperature, see where it vanishes. That gives us Tc, and that helps us mark this boundary between a superfluid and sort of a normal state. Similarly, on the low hopping side, we can mark a boundary where you have an insulator, and at some temperature scale, that gap in the insulating regime closes and you go into this normal state. This normal state is actually the quantum critical state, which is being governed by the zero temperature critical point here. Okay, so this is the kind of phase diagram you can get for simple looking Hubbard models like this. And there's a lot of effort right now in understanding the dynamics in this quantum critical region. And a number of people, again, the problem with this region is the lack of theoretical tools. So a number of people are using these ADS-CFT methods again, Sachdev and collaborators, to understand this regime. And the reason this regime is difficult is because, you know, here we had a well-defined ground state and its low-lying excitations, which were the phonons of the superfluid. On this side, we have a different ground state and its excitations, which are gapped. But precisely at the critical point, all of these states have become equally probably mixed up. And there is no one scale that can be separated. And as a result, the only scale that drives this region is the temperature. So what we are going to do now, and we can't, of course, get to all the dynamics yet. That is still an open problem in this field. But we'll see what are some of the things we can learn about this critical region from the simulations. Okay, so the first thing I want to show you is that those sharp peaks we saw in the interference pattern can emerge not just from a very coherent superfluid, but also from this critical region above TC. So sharp interference patterns should not just be associated with an ordered phase. And that evidence is here. What I'm showing, and I've written down here, this is theory, because it looks very much like the experimental data, but it really is coming out of the theoretical simulations. So what is shown here is the momentum distribution convolved with that 1 year function. And here is a cut through that. And at a temperature twice TC, so it's in the normal state. And what you see is there's some background, but over and above that, there are these extremely sharp peaks which are coming not from the condensate, but from some kind of critical state, which nevertheless has huge fluctuations. So I should call it like a critical state coherence. So the critical state is, by normal, we would say it's a state which is incoherent. But the critical state is not an incoherent state. It has some degree of coherence, though not long range order. And that is showing up in these extremely sharp peaks. So an analysis of this kind of structure in the data has not been done, but I think it would be very worthwhile to look at it more quantitatively to extract this kind of physics. Okay.
I cannot see the scales. Are the heights of the peaks comparable, this one and the one from the experiments that this due to?
Yeah, they are comparable. So what you see is, of course, if you go this, the height of this peak will become of order n if it becomes truly coherent. And you, right, when you get into the ordered phase, effectively all the bosons are starting to contribute. And you see that. When you go below TC, this is what I showed you, that sharp peak. There's another even sharper order n effect riding on top of that. But even above TC, these peaks are very sharp. But the quantitative measurement has to be done to extract these comparisons in more detail. Okay, so what is the physics? The physics of this is quite beautiful. What is emerging is that there is a temperature that we call T degeneracy, where the quantum effects first start to happen. That's where bosons start exchanging, the thermal de Broglie wavelengths overlap, and the system realizes that it's a bosonic system. That happens at some temperature here. And typically in helium-4, for example, once you reach degeneracy, the system also becomes superfluid. So at large tunneling, that is what would happen. This red line here is TC. It's the temperature at which the system would become a coherent superfluid. And that happens close to the degeneracy temperature. Now what is being done by this tuning of tunneling relative to U is that you're suppressing TC. And as a result, there is this large window opening up where the system has these ring exchanges. So bosons become superfluid by undergoing ring exchanges. And initially, it starts out with just two bosons exchanging, and then four, and so on. And once you have a macroscopic ring exchange, that's the superfluid transition. But what happens in this strongly coupled region is that because TC is suppressed, you get larger and larger ring exchanges without the system getting into a totally coherent state. Okay, and so here, this is the critical, I've called it a critical condensate with very large exchanges, but not enough coupling at the very end to form this long-range coherent state. And because of that large ring exchange, the momentum distribution starts to build up a lot of weight at large wavelengths or small momenta. And that's really the behavior of the strongly interacting normal state. Okay, so that's one aspect of strongly coupled systems. There are quantum critical points. And around those quantum critical points, there are very strong quantum effects, even above the normal state. Then in the last some minutes, I'll just touch on a few other ideas that we have to look at these systems through other defects, other topological defects. And as you know, in a superfluid, there is broken gauge invariance. So it has low-lying Goldstone modes. And these are the phonons. In addition, you can have these topological defects, which are vortices. And recently, people have been able to see these through interference experiments. What is done is to take two clouds, and when you interfere these clouds, if they have these topological defects, they make distinct signatures in the interference pattern. It picks up the additional pi shift in the vortices in these zipper patterns. So we would like to look at similar effects in our transition here, because there are the finite temperature transition is generated by vortices which are thermal in nature. But the more interesting one are these quantum vortices, which occur at zero temperature or low temperature. And this is happening because of quantum tunneling. So how does that affect the interference pattern? And this is what a quantum vortex looks like, if you want to visualize it. I've called them cosmic strings, thanks to discussions with Patrick. But this is what they look like. These are vortices in space and time. And a quantum vortex is something that, so a vortex is a normal core in the superfluid. And a quantum vortex is one which tunnels
in imaginary time from one point to another. And these quantum fluctuations then disrupt the very nice order in the superfluid and show up as signatures in the interference pattern. Recently, there has been another breakthrough in the field in terms of being able to do very local measurements, something like scanning, tunneling, spectroscopy. They can do single atom addressability. And so here are some pictures, very high profile papers coming out from Harvard and Emmanuel Bloch's group and Chicago, showing single site addressability and imaging these atoms and measuring their fluctuations. So motivated by that, we've gone to a very fundamental principle, the fluctuation dissipation theorem, to address the issue I brought up at the beginning, which is, given a Hamiltonian, how can we find the phase diagram? And so I described some efforts through the momentum distribution function, but this effort, the latest one, is a very direct way to get the phase diagram. And the idea is really quite simple. You can measure the local dense number fluctuations as well as the local compressibility. By changing the trap frequency, you can change the chemical potential and measure the local fluctuation at a site. And this ratio, which I call R, the ratio of the compressibility to the number fluctuations, has very different behavior in the three phases, the superfluid, MOT, and the critical region. So just as a sanity check first, let's look at high temperatures. So this is R inverse plotted versus temperature, and what you see is that it's linear, as we expect. At high temperatures, the fluctuation dissipation theorem tells us that this ratio should be just inverse temperature. So if I look at R inverse, it should go like the temperature, and that's what it does. Now, when you come to low temperatures, you see that R, which is compressibility divided by number fluctuations, goes to zero at low temperatures. Beta is inverse temperature here. It goes to zero. In a superfluid, it goes to a constant. And in the critical regime, it remains linear in temperature with a prefactor, which is less than one. So just from such data, this is numerical data, but similar data taken experimentally, you can then get this whole phase diagram out. And I won't take you through that. I just want to flash it to say that those MOT regions and superfluid regions can all be mapped out. These boundaries can be mapped out from that single quantity R. So now I'm coming up to the very end here. Let me just conclude that I hope I've given you some window. It was a very broad brush stroke here, but I wanted to give you a flavor about materials, how they are generating very interesting models. The ones I talked about are not even the most interesting ones. There are even fascinating models which have spin liquid behavior and other topological states, but at least there has to be a way of getting to the antiferromagnet in the optical lattices before, you know, they can stick their neck out and talk about more exotic phases. But that doesn't stop us theoretically from going after them. And I hope I've also given you a flavor for how to use very different principles, these topological defects and fluctuation dissipation theorem, to possibly map out these phase diagrams. So let me end by thanking my collaborators. These are my boson friends, my happy boson friends, Yasuyuki Kato, Naoki Kawashima from ISSP, Eric Duchon and Mason Swanson are my students, and my grumpy fermion friends, Teresa Paiva, Yen Li Lo, Mohit Randeria, and Richard Skeletar, and I am their supersymmetric partner. So thank you.
Anthony, you said that reaching three-dimensional ordered antiferromagnet in optical lattices has been difficult so far. What about two-dimension? Does it make the problem worse?
They haven't done that yet, but it would make the problem worse, because you see, you will have the T nail
is stabilized because of coupling between the layers. So once you go to two dimensions, that order is anyway destroyed by Merman-Wagner.
But then you can access the spin liquid directly.
Yes, yes. So that has not been done yet. You know, they're very keen to sort of first nail the antiferromagnet. But, and that temperature should certainly be higher. The spin liquid temperature will be much smaller because of the fluctuations.
Because even the entropy issue may be overcome because of
because of the entanglement entropy?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. I see thermometry right now as a major bottleneck there. In two ways. One is even to get the temperature down, get the entropy down, but the second thing is also measuring the temperature. So again, for that, the fluctuation dissipation theorem is a good way to get to the temperature value itself.
Does disorder play any role in this in the experiment? Or?
Disorder?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. That's an important question. So one of the things, that's another major reason for going to optical lattices. There's no getting away from disorder in the condensed matter systems. It's there. Even this doping, you are substituting, with some dopant, and that's anyway inevitably putting in disorder. So here, the nice thing is that you can create systems which are completely disorder-free, but then you can also add disorder in a controlled way. So the whole field of localization physics can be tried out here. And there's been a lot of progress there. For example, the first problem you would try is just say non-interacting particles with some random potential. And that is known as the, and that produces a localized phase called the Anderson localized phase. It has never been seen in any material system because you can never have non-interacting electrons. There's always some interaction. So the predictions of that theory could never really be tested. Now in these cold atom experiments, there are experiments by Aspe's group in France as well as Ignuzio's group in Italy, and they have managed to use speckle patterns. You know, they take some glass and scratch it, and through that speckle pattern generate a disorder potential, and they have been able to see localization coming from these interference of waves. So that's the first step. That has been achieved. Now, the next step of looking at interaction and disorder, this is a major, major problem in condensed matter physics, that is now starting systematically by tuning the interactions as well as random potentials.
In reading about these either optical lattices or emulators or other implementations, looks like one would like to see these experiment as a realization of a quantum computer. But it's not really that, right? In the sense that one is not able to do whatever you like with these experiments. So what is one of the goals that can be achieved with this kind of experiment that cannot be achieved with, for example, any kind of a simulation, numerical simulation?
Right. So there's still, the two things are still a little disjoint. It hasn't come together. But let's say in the ultimate step, when all this thermometry is controlled, we would not need the simulations anymore. Because the simulations, in other words, people like me are out of business. But that'll be a long time in the future, after my lifetime, I hope. So the point would be that the simulations I am doing are on a classical computer. So if you look at these simulations, they have issues between bosons and fermions. Fermions get stuck because of the sign problem and so on. If you do the same emulation, let's call it, with the Hamiltonians on these optical lattices, they don't care whether they are bosons or fermions. Hopefully they will achieve the ground state in the same amount of time and tell you, yes, Hubbard model has a D-wave superconducting ground state. That's the kind of ultimate goal. And why Hubbard model? Give it like some more frustrated spin systems. where we don't even have an idea about what are the ground states. These are supposed to be interesting topological spin liquid states. That the emulator would be able to achieve that. But I've tried to present a very realistic picture where you can see what the bottlenecks are. There are also always going to be life for people like us, because we still need to understand how to probe them. It may exist, but how do you probe them?
So you mentioned, I think at the beginning, that the experimental situation with the fermionic atoms was not as well developed as with the bosonic ones. And could that somehow be related to the same problems you also have in the simulations that make fermions harder to work with?
Not the same, but it is related to scattering cross sections between fermions and between bosons. So they often put some bosonic system along with the fermionic to help in the, you know, you have to exchange entropy. You have to take entropy away from one system. So they mix it with bosons in order to remove entropy from the fermionic system, except sometimes if the Bose system becomes superfluid, then it's not very helpful. Then it can't take away that entropy. So while it's not related, there are aspects of fermions which are different.
Which is, you're saying that they're difficult to thermalize.
Yes, yes.
So I just want, and then you were commenting on this quantum simulator. One advantage of this will be scalability. You could do maybe 10,000 atoms, whereas numerically you are handicapped
right. When
you come to scaling.
So right now I didn't mention that, but for bosons, we can do 1 million bosons. Hmm. And that's also the size of the experimental system. But the same thing for fermions will be very hard. So yes, that's a good point.
If there aren't any further questions, let me first remind you that there should be some snacks downstairs. And let's thank her.